introductions will made. We will now turn to 99-0182, State Ex-Rel James Mentek versus David Schwartz. Stephen Compton will be representing, I think you represent Mr. Mentek, don't you? Our statement here is wrong. And Mr. Walford is Assistant Attorney General. You represent David Schwartz, right? Counsel? Okay. Mr. Compton, first on behalf of the court, we want to thank you for agreeing to take this case. Mr. Mentek was not represented in his petition for review here, and that you have been kind enough to take our request that you represent him. So with that, Mr. Compton, would you please stand and tell us what this case is about?
Good morning, Justices. Again, my name is Stephen Compton, and as Chief Justice Abrahamson just indicated, I am representing the petitioner, James Mentek, in this matter. Before I begin my presentation, I would like to also thank the court for allowing me to again participate in the pro bono appeals program. Frankly, it's both an honor and a reward to appear before you today in this very important process.
You haven't heard our questions yet.
I'm trying to set it up.
As I am.
Now, like many of the cases that come before you, this case arises with a very long and somewhat tortured history, both from a procedural aspect and a substantive aspect. However, from my perspective, I believe that we can distill this case down to two relatively straightforward issues. The first of which is whether the statutory due process right to assistance of counsel during a probation revocation hearing pursuant to Wisconsin Administrative Code HA Section 2.05 sub 3 extends logically to administrative appeals pursuant to HA Section 2.05 sub 8. Having said that now out loud, it doesn't necessarily seem quite so straightforward. However, I will try my best to make it straightforward. The second issue is, and irrespective really of that first issue, what is the appropriate remedy when an attorney deprives his client of the due process rights of review and appeal of an administrative decision by promising, but then reneging on that promise, to file an appeal within the statutory time limit set forth by the administrative rule? Now, in considering these two issues, I think it is important to discuss some of the background in this case, both the facts and some procedural issues that arose. So if the court will indulge me, I'd like to take a minute to briefly recite those facts that I think are relevant here today. First, as you know, in 1993, Mentek pled guilty to issuing a forged check. He was sentenced to 10 years, but that was stayed, and he was placed on probation with conditions. In 1996 and 1997, he engaged in certain actions which precipitated revocation proceedings. Now, the revocation proceedings began in April of 1997. And it's very interesting, as you look through the record, you'll see that the revocation proceedings started and stopped in July of that year. Then they were put off again. They were continued until October. They were withdrawn in November.
By the department.
By the department.
Or division. Or whatever
division.
You call it.
And then finally, they were completed in February of 1998.
How can they get restarted when they already terminated them?
Well, that is a very, very good question. And again, there are a myriad of issues that are potentially considered in this case, and I think that is one of them. Mr. Mentek did raise that in his writ of certiorari with the court. However, the circuit court didn't consider it, and now the case has come up basically on just the two issues that were here today.
When the revocation was withdrawn before it was restarted again, was the defendant still sitting on a VOP hold, or was he in custody on something else?
Justice, if when you look at the record in this case, you will be amazed at the procedural things that were going back and forth. And Mr. Mentek was engaging in every avenue that he saw fit to get out of jail. However, he never did succeed, despite the fact that he got a circuit court order requiring his release. There was, according to Mr. Mentek, some shenanigans in this regard, but there was a circuit court order for his release. The department said, don't release him. He was held. The proceedings were withdrawn. His expectation that he would be released never came to fruition. And then in December, there were statements by the department that they were going to reinstate these proceedings.
And so, he had several convictions and several probations.
That is correct.
A couple.
That is
different
correct.
Different offenses. So is it always clear what he's being held on?
Well, I am not clear.
Okay, you're not clear. Well, I wasn't clear in the record either. But are you saying that all these are not before us? I'm sort of looking for his petition for review. What did he say in his petition for review here?
Well, in his petition for review, he does reference his writ of certiorari, which has, I think, 42 claims of error.
Right.
So he does, I think, bootstrap it in if you wanted to consider that issue. However, I'm not prepared to talk about that issue.
Okay. I get the picture.
But suffice it to say, I mean, that procedural wrangle is very interesting, and there's lots of back and forth in that regard.
He seems to be a good jailhouse lawyer.
He's a very good jailhouse lawyer, and one of the things that I think supports the arguments later is that very fact, that he's very studious, he's very conscientious about time limits, and he's very aggressive in pursuing his rights under the law. Okay, well, in any event, in February of 1998, he does proceed to a hearing, and there is a decision shortly thereafter on March 6th by Administrative Law Judge Wiedenhoft revoking his probation. Now, shortly thereafter, Mentek and Miller, according to Mr. Mentek, they discuss the fact that Mr. Mentek would like to take an appeal of this case. Right, and memorialized in the record and in my brief I've submitted to you are several letters that seem to indicate that that is in fact the truth. Specifically, on March 13, 1998, there was a letter from Attorney Miller, who was appointed to represent Mr. Mentek, as you well know, indicating that, quote, I will be filing the appeal on the decision issued on March 6, 1998, by Mr. Wiedenhoff revoking your probation early next week. Now, that document is not in the record. I have filed a motion to supplement the record with that, and I would ask that that motion be entertained and accepted here today. Secondly, on March 25th of 1998, Attorney Miller again drafts a letter to Mr. Mentek, and in there he states, contrary to his March 13th letter, that he is not going to be filing an appeal on Mr. Mentek's behalf. And he gives the letter substance by explaining why it is that he's not going to appeal. And he ends the letter by noting that Mentek is free to file a writ of certiorari to challenge the decision of the administrative law judge.
And Mr. Compton, it appears that he is reading the notice given by the division that you have an alternative. You don't have to do both.
Correct.
Do you happen to know where that notice is in the record? Is it in the record?
It is in the record, Your Honor. I specifically saw it yesterday, and it's in I think it's Exhibit F.
Okay. How do you read that notice?
Well, quite frankly, I concede that the petitioner in this case must exhaust his administrative remedies.
Well, I'm going to question you about that. Why do you think that?
Well, I
found that a strange concession, frankly. And it's a legal concession, so it doesn't bind the court, of course. Go ahead.
Right.
Now that I've said that to you, right. I can feel about everything else.
Right.
Go ahead, counsel.
Well, I guess I see the perspective from the petitioner's side and from Attorney Miller's side, thinking that there's the possibility that you can go both routes. However, from my own practice and my dealings with the law, I tend to take a bit more strict construction on the fact that if there's an administrative appeal, it's my obligation as an attorney to file through that process rather than a collateral challenge, if you will, on a writ of certiorari.
Well, I agree that is probably the safer and the better route. But your client has continually stated that 801.027 does not apply to this case because this is not a Department of Corrections case. It is a Department of Administration Division of Hearing and Appeals case. And the state finally concedes that in its brief here, right? So you don't have a statutory requirement for administrative exhaustion.
Right. That's absolutely true. I mean, that and the way in which it arose was through the state's motion to dismiss, summarily dismiss, based on that. And that
in the circuit court.
In the circuit court.
And then the circuit court did that.
That is correct.
And held that way against your client.
Correct.
And the Court of Appeals?
The Court of Appeals upheld that determination. Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be an erroneous interpretation of the law.
Yes, it is.
And there are, then if you don't get under that statute, you're into administrative appeals, and there, case law indicates, if you want to play it safe, you better touch all those bases before you come to court. On the other hand, it's not a jurisdictional issue for the court. The court does have the power to hear the case, even if you haven't gone through all your administrative remedies, if in its discretion it thinks on balance it's okay. That's Nodell and Investment Corp and County of Sauk versus Draker, right?
Right.
So at least it's not a jurisdictional issue. It might have been under the statute.
That is true.
When I say subject matter jurisdiction, court always has subject matter jurisdiction. Question is whether it's competent. It's not competent if all the statutory bases haven't been touched, right?
Right.
So, but we don't have to worry about statute now because it's not 801, whatever that number is.
I think it's 80102 sub 7.
So, in light of that, why are you willing to say that you're conceding that?
Well, I guess because I'm convinced as to my issues regarding
and you want to get to the main meaty event, right?
Well, I suppose that might not be a safer route for my client. So if the court is so inclined to rule that the court could have exercised discretion and considered that writ of certiorari, I certainly would accept that route.
Okay. All right, counsel. Okay, so you want to get to ineffective assistance of counsel?
Right.
All right.
Now, as this court knows, following the denial of the writ of certiorari, Mr. Mentek filed his notice of appeal, and the Court of Appeals ultimately ruled in this case that the circuit court's decision would be upheld in a 2-1 decision, Judge Schneider writing the decision and Judge Brown dissenting vigorously. What I think is important from the Court of Appeals decision is first that they did squarely address the issue of effective assistance of counsel, kind of getting over the hurdle that we were just talking about with the exhaustion remedies. And then secondly, the court dropped a fortuitous footnote, I think for my client, regarding the fact that this court, the Supreme Court, has authority to draft an appropriate remedy under circumstances such as these. Okay, now as far as the argument is concerned, the arguments in support of Mr. Mentek's position, again, track the statement of issues, and that's, first of all, Mentek's statutory right to an appointed counsel during the probation revocation hearing pursuant to HA Section 2.05 sub 3 extends logically to administrative appeals under sub 8 of that section.
Also, let me just ask you about that. I'm not sure if we handed out the procedure and practice. I assume one of counsel did for us.
That would be me.
Okay. Looking at 205.03, client's rights, as I read this, it says the client's rights at the hearing. Now we're talking about the administrative hearing. This is the hearing before the ALJ. The right to be present, the right to deny an allegation, the right to be heard and present witnesses, the right to present documentary evidence. The reason I'm reading this, I'll come to that. The right to question witnesses, the right to assistance of counsel. Well, all of those rights are rights that you would assume would be at that ALJ hearing. Certainly, these are not, when we're talking about documentary evidence, questioning witnesses, presenting witnesses, when you turn over to 8, appeal, these would be things that would not be used at the appellate level. And also, that reads, the client's attorney, if any. And I'm just wondering, it seems to me that it's not, you don't read them the same, do you? In other words, one is applying to the appellate review, and one is applying to the first hearing, the administrative hearing.
And I understand that perspective. My perspective from the start, however, is that this provision is clear on its face that it does, in fact, provide assistance of counsel at all stages of the hearing.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's not unambiguous. I'm saying I would agree, and I think you argued that in the brief.
Well, let's just double back on that. Suppose we have a client who's well-to-do and has his own attorney paid for by himself. So you always got the right to bring in an attorney at any hearing, whether or not you have a constitutional right to have appointed counsel.
Well, the case law has considered those issues. I mean, they're back in the 70s and through the 80s. The courts, the various courts, our court as well as the United States Supreme Court, have tackled those issues. And in the early stages, they said basically you didn't have the right. And then it progressed to, well, you do have the right, but in some cases they were just to sit idly by and kind of be an idle participant. I think the trend in the law is that under these circumstances, and under most cases, particularly where it's delineated, they do have the right to have counsel there, and that counsel can be effective by participating in the process.
But then sometimes you have a right to appointed counsel because you have an absolute constitutional right to be represented by counsel. And in this case, you do not have that absolute constitutional right, correct?
That is correct. And I'm not arguing that it's a constitutional right. It is a statutory provision.
So if he had, and here he happened to have appointed counsel.
He had appointed counsel.
So then the issue is, what is the authority of that, not only the authority, what is the obligation of that appointed counsel, right?
That is correct. I mean, and I think that not only did he have the right to appointed counsel, again at the hearing, but also in the appeal phase. And since he had that right, as we all know, I mean, the case law is clear, when you have the right to counsel and counsel participates, you have the right to effective assistance of counsel.
Well, is that why they used if any? the client's attorney, if any, because you don't have an absolute constitutional right? I mean, what does if any mean?
Well, I think that the if any means that if an attorney is appointed or if an attorney is in the process pursuant to a paying client, then the provision applies.
So that's giving the right to counsel at appeal.
Correct. And that's how I read it. And again, if I could back up just a minute, when you look at HA 2.05, right, and the reason why I gave it to you is so you could see this, and I was looking at this last night again and thinking to myself, that section is titled Revocation Hearing. 2.05 is titled Revocation Hearing. Under that section, there are 9 subsections. And one of those subsections is the appeal. And it's something that I overlooked in my brief, but I think it's very important, as I was considering again last night, as I said, that 2.05 is titled Revocation Hearing, and under that provision is the appeal provisions. So again, on its face, right, the process and the subsection 3, which talks about the right to counsel, would seem to indicate clearly that assistance of counsel flows through that entire section and through the appeal stage.
Counsel, that's why I was, that was my question, because the wording is obviously different in 3 than it is in 8. In 3, it talks about the right to assistance of counsel. And in 8, as you have indicated, it talks about, in the plain language, says, if any. And it would seem to me that we're not talking about a constitutional situation. We're talking about a legislative or administrative condition here, or this is basically legislative language, and they weren't contemplating, at least on the plain language, because it says if any. In other words, why didn't they simply say the right to assistance of counsel at the appellate stage?
And that's a very good point, and it's a point that is obviously troublesome to my position. However, I think, again, my perspective is that it is clear in its face that it does apply, and if not, Justice Wilcox, then, as Judge Brown pointed out in his dissent, there is some ambiguity within this language. And then you get to the second consideration, which is that 2.05 sub 3 is ambiguous because reasonable people could interpret it to mean two things. As the state will argue and Judge Snyder argued, that it doesn't apply because the heading says what it says. On the other hand, as Judge Brown argued, and I'm advocating now, the provisions of sub 3 seem to indicate pre-hearing, hearing, and post-hearing rights. Right, so it isn't clear on its face. There is some ambiguity there.
Counsel, I look at the sub 2 amendments, and that has that same if any qualification. And yet there seems to be no dispute that an attorney, the client has a right at the hearing to assistance of counsel under 3F, and yet 2, dealing with amendments prior to the hearing, and I suppose during the hearing, well, maybe just prior to the hearing, also uses that same language.
So does subsection 1.
It doesn't seem to me, when you read it in those other areas, that it suggests that it undermines your argument, because it appears other places too.
Well, that's because 2.051 and 2.058 deal with deal with the individual in terms of who gets something. So the it says the client's going to get it, and also the counsel, if any. And 8 says that on the other end of it, who is going to file for the appeal, and it's the client or the lawyer, whereas 3 only deals with the client's rights.
And again, from a common sense perspective, mean to adopt the Court of Appeals rationale says that it's only at that hearing, just that one tiny little chunk, do you get the assistance of counsel. And if you read it to say you don't get it beforehand, you don't get it afterwards, again, it seems to undermine the whole purpose and process. And as Judge Brown pointed out in his dissent, the Gagnon versus Scarpelli case was on the books when they drafted this. And he asserts, and I advocate as well, that the legislative folks who were drafting this recognized that, and they provided additional rights beyond the Gagnon and Scarpelli requirements. Right, so it seems a little odd, then, that they would be giving these extra rights, and then we're saying, no, you can't have it on appeal, and you can't have it during the pre-hearing. Right, and again, 2.05 is entitled Revocation Hearing. It talks about the entire process.
Before you, the time's running out, I'd like you to tell me what remedy you think is the correct remedy here.
Well, if we get to the remedy phase, and again, irrespective of how you answer, you know, that first point, but I think as a matter of law, you can find that ineffective assistance of counsel was rendered
in
this case.
On the basis of these letters?
Right, on the basis of those letters. Again, there was a promise made. Mr. Mentek relied on that promise, and there was a breach of that promise to the detriment of Mr. Mentek, and to the significant detriment. As you pointed out, Chief Justice, in the Vanderbeek case, the loss of probation is a grievous loss.
Okay, and then what do you get?
Well, then you get one of two things. If you agree with my interpretation on the assistance of counsel under 2.05, then we get a remand back to the division with Mr. Mentek having the right to have an attorney present to assist him with his appeal. If I'm wrong...
Wait a minute, to assist in the appeal. So what you really want is exhaust your remedies and then you'll go to circuit court. Go ahead.
Correct.
Okay.
And I think, and my client is willing to do that. He has told me specifically that that's what he would like to do. Again, if I'm wrong, though, on that, then at the very least, with the cases that I cited, and also the State versus Schmelzer case, which the state cited, I think that you can fashion a remedy for a remand back to, again, a division for Mr. Mentek to proceed on his own.
Now, if it goes back to the division, who hears the appeal?
The administrator would hear the appeal.
It's not the same person as the administrative, as the hearing examiner here.
It is not. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Compton. You have 5 minutes. Mr. Walford.
May it please the court. My name is William C. Wolford. I'm representing Mr. Schwarz on this appeal. Let me first briefly discuss the exhaustion of administrative remedies. The circuit court denied the petition for a writ of certiorari in this case because Mr. Mentek failed to file a timely administrative appeal and therefore failed to exhaust his administrative remedies. The respondent contends that the circuit court's action was correct, although the particular statute cited by the Court of Appeals, WSSTAT Section 801.027-9596, was not applicable to actions against the respondent in this case. Now, let me give you a little background on this. This was disputed at the trial court level, but on appeal, it was not disputed by Mr. Mentek. It was not raised. He just raised the ineffective assistance issue. We didn't really focus on that particular statute, and the Court of Appeals decided it applied. When I started preparing my Supreme Court brief, I looked at the statute, and I realized because of the language, it didn't apply. And
so this is the first time you've raised that issue in any court.
That's right. And we concede that it doesn't apply, but we feel that for the reasons stated in my brief that exhaustion of administrative remedies is still required.
do you agree that it does not debar the court from taking jurisdiction, circuit court?
I think that is correct.
You think I correctly stated the law?
Pardon me?
You think I correctly stated the law?
Yes.
That's a safe answer. Okay.
Now, you also asked about the notice, and it may be in the record at various places, but one of the places it's in the record, I'm talking about the cover letter.
Yes, that's right. I'd like to see that. Where is that?
That accompanied the decision. I think that's what you were talking about. That would be document 2 in the record, and I think it's page 43.
Okay.
That's an attachment to the petition for the writ of certiorari. Now, our main argument in this case is that Mr. Mentek was not denied the right to the effective assistance of counsel in connection with the administrative appeal in this case because he didn't have the right to the assistance of counsel for that appeal. He claims that he has a statutory right to counsel both at the probation revocation hearing and on the administrative appeal.
Before you get into the ineffective assistance of counsel, have you waived the argument on on administrative exhaustion?
I think the respondent can raise any issue to affirm this decision of the court below.
Even if it's not done before. Are you stopped because you have not raised this before? You've relied on a statute, even though the pro se defendant here has said it didn't apply.
Well, my recollection of our brief in the Court of Appeals is that we didn't discuss that issue at all. I think at the trial court level, I think there was much confusion, and I think the district attorney believed that the PLRA applied and was arguing on the basis of that statute, which has changed the law, of course, but still has the same language that we think makes it not applicable here. But I don't think it were a stop from it at this point.
Now, what about the substitution issue? We haven't really talked about that, just for a moment. He filed a motion. It was not properly labeled for a change of venue, but he wanted a substitution. He never got that. Was he entitled to a substitution account of a judge?
I have not really looked at that issue since I dealt with it in the Court of Appeals because it was not raised in the petition for review. I quite frankly don't know what happened. It's very confusing as to what happened in the trial court on that issue. I'm not sure why the judge that ended up being involved in the case being substituted against was involved.
If that was error, does he have a right to have a new cert hearing?
Pardon me?
If that was error, that the judge did not substitute herself, does that mean that was an invalid hearing?
It probably does, but the Court of Appeals did not address that issue and determined it to be moot. As I said, Mr. Mentek claims he has a statutory right to counsel both at the probation revocation hearing and on the administrative appeal from the decision. We disagree for several reasons. First, the right to counsel has been provided not by statute, but by administrative rule. Second, respondent contends that the administrative rule in question, Chapter HA2, only specifies there is a right to the assistance of counsel at the revocation hearing, not the administrative appeal. It's our contention the rule is not ambiguous.
That mean that that if he has counsel, that the administrative agency can say you can't come with counsel to appeal?
No, I think that he can have counsel. There's just not a right to counsel, and indeed, many probationers do have counsel on the appeal.
Okay, so then if the counsel's ineffective on an appeal, his only remedy, you say, is to sue the attorney. Is that the point?
We believe because there is no right to counsel on the appeal, that counsel cannot be ineffective.
Why would this be drafted so you have a right at the hearing but no right of counsel on appeal? What's the point of that?
Well, I think...
It seems to me if there's a right to counsel, the division would want counsel, so it would make it easier. Pro se is very difficult.
I think the reason is this. Obviously, the genesis of the rule is a response to Gagnon versus Scarpelli. And that case says that the agency takes a case-by-case approach to whether counsel is required at the revocation hearing. I think the agency made a determination to have counsel at all revocation hearings as a matter of administrative convenience. Frankly, I think it would be a nightmare to try to determine on a case-by-case basis when there should be counsel and when there shouldn't be. But Gagnon versus Scarpelli doesn't talk at all about administrative appeals. It's not dealing with appeals. And
the argument that this revocation hearing is really one big thing. First you have a little hearing, then you have a little review, and it's all part of the revocation hearing.
Well, I mean, that would be one way to look at it, but I think that it is not, and Scarpelli doesn't talk about the hearing at all, and it is more difficult to do the hearing pro se and prepare for that hearing than it is to do the appeal. In fact, I would like to just read from Mr. Mentek's petition for review at page 19. In that regard, he says, as is clear from both this appeal and the extensive writ of certiorari filed by Mentek in the trial court, Mentek is both an articulate and forceful litigator and has a working knowledge of the law, being able to formulate meritorious argument and support the same with state and federal law. Had Mentek known that Attorney Miller would not be filing an appeal, Mentek would not have hesitated to file one himself, which he did, in fact, do at a later point in time. I view this more as a matter of timing and notice. He could have handled the appeal in this case, and I mean, if you look at all his pleadings, what he did in the...
There's no question of his competence. I mean, he obviously spotted a problem with the statute before lawyers or judges in this case did. So we're not questioning whether he's competent. The question is whether he had a statutory right to a lawyer. Even if you're competent, you can have a right to counsel. Does the public defender's office, this was a public defender's appointment, wasn't it?
Yes, it's my understanding that it was.
Do they advise counsel to that they represent do they advise the client that they represent the client all through, including the appeal?
I don't know the answer to that.
This lawyer thought he represented him through appeal.
He apparently did. One of the problems here, and all my arguments here are based on the record as it is presented and the documentary evidence, the letters. I don't know what in fact happened. I've never spoken to Mr. Miller. I think it's possible that he may have communicated orally to Mr. Mentek before the due date saying I'm not going to file appeal, but I don't know. And we feel that eventually there would need to be a Mockner hearing to determine those factually.
Just let me say, do you object to this letter being supplemented in the record?
No.
Okay. Sorry. Bradley and then Wilcox.
Counsel, with regard to the issue of on appeal, in reading the state public defender statute, it seems to me that if this case went to appeal and then went to the circuit court after that, that they would be entitled under the state public defender statute, if indigent, to have an attorney represent them.
You mean on certiorari?
Yes. Uh-huh. Under 977.05.4J, perhaps. I'm not sure. I'm just asking because it says in that statute that at the request of any person,
if you're determined indigent by the state public defender, that if you're going to be before any court, you have a right to state public defender representation and indigent. That's a quick reading of it.
I'm not certain about the answer to that. It's possible it's discretionary.
I didn't read that as discretionary. I mean, I read it at the request of any person determined by the state public defender to be indigent, or upon any referral of any court, prosecutor, writ of error, appeal, action, or proceeding for habeas, or other post-conviction or any post-commitment remedy on behalf of the person before any court. If the state public defender determines, it should be pursued. So
I guess all I can tell you is that most of the cert actions we see, the people are not represented. They're appearing pro se, and it's our position they're certainly not in, they don't have any constitutional right to counsel for that. But I can't say for certain what the policy of the public defender is, or what, you know, how they deal with cert actions.
Counsel, I just wanted to touch briefly on the same question that I asked your opposing counsel under 205, and just the wording of 205, 2.053, where specifically they go through the right to be present, the right to deny allegations, the right to present witnesses, and then finally, I'll just skip quickly to F, the right to assistance of counsel. Now, my peers on the court have indicated, well, isn't that strengthened by language, if any, in like 1 and 2, and then what I was calling to opposing counsel's attention, sub 8, which talked about if any, and I was, it seemed to me, and I, you can argue, obviously, whichever way you want, but it seems to me that the only definitive right to counsel under the, let's say, administrative or legislative requirements seems to be at that hearing stage. I'm talking about the revocation hearing and not at the appellate stage. And do you think that the words, if any, strengthen that, or it doesn't it make any difference?
I believe that that the only grant of the assistance of counsel, the right to assistance of counsel, is under paren 3, the which deals with a revocation hearing, and I think that the language in 205 paren 8 simply means that if you have counsel, the counsel can file the appeal. There, counsel is not prohibited as far as the appeal is concerned, but it doesn't suggest to me that it is something that is required. I don't agree with Judge Brown's dissent, the way he interpreted that provision.
Do you think this is good public policy, counsel? Do you think it's good public policy? And after all, you represent the state of Wisconsin. You think it's good public policy that the state revoke probation when there's been ineffective assistance of counsel? You think the person should be kept, have liberty taken away when there's ineffective assistance of counsel? And the state of Wisconsin should argue we keep him in prison, and that his remedy is to sue the lawyer for damages. Is that good public policy? You think that's what was intended here?
Well, I guess we don't think that there was ineffective assistance of counsel because he doesn't have...
Well, that's a different issue,
right.
Counsel. It may be that there wasn't ineffective assistance of counsel. It may be that this is a frivolous appeal and a frivolous writ of certiorari. I have no way of knowing, and that's not before us. Question is the one I posed to you. Do you think that's good public policy?
I'll answer it. I'll try to answer it in this way. Our concern is not so much about the facts of this particular case. I mean, it's hard not to be assuming that they are, as are alleged, to be somewhat sympathetic to his situation. The concern is the floodgates that could be opened with respect to issues relating to ineffective assistance of counsel in connection with this appeal, not for missing a deadline, but for failing to raise an issue and therefore failing to exhaust and not being able to pursue that on cert, or doing a bad job on the appeal. It's a much broader one than this. I view this more as a, as I said before, more of a notice problem, and I think some of it could be addressed by changing the cover letter, assuming that the court ruled in our favor, to make it clear that you can have an attorney, but you don't have the right to the assistance of counsel on the appeal, and therefore be sure that it gets filed in time.
That's not clear on the cover letter. I haven't been able to find it.
I agree it's not clear about the exhaustion of administrative remedies either. I would recommend to them that they change that to clarify that.
You can read that to say it's an either or, you can, or both, that you can either go up on appeal within the division, you can you need not, but if you do that, you can also go to court, but you needn't do that, you can go to court first. So you can read it that way, right?
Yes, I think you can. So, you know, I...
So he's been misled here by the department, the division.
Well, I think it could have been read in that way. Now, but those are general concerns about the ineffective assistance of counsel where the rule doesn't, you know, really grant it.
When I first looked at this case, I thought of Schmelzer versus Murphy. And you cite that in your brief. Now, that is a situation where there's ineffective assistance of counsel, not for a myriad of issues. And this comes to mind when you're saying you're concerned from an institutional point about the floodgate, not just missing a time limit. And in Schmelzer, you know, you have the right to an attorney on appeal and through filing, if I recall, filing the petition for appeal, not the right to have an attorney be here, you know, the argument of all of the merits and everything. And we have said that although you don't have a right to have an attorney in this court, that you have the right, and we, with regard to the filing of a petition for review, if they fail to file it, that's ineffective assistance of counsel, and we do it under the writ of, I guess, habeas. Why doesn't that procedure apply, or why cannot that procedure?
Could apply here. As I recall it, Schmelzer, you concluded that he did have a statutory right to counsel.
Someone filed,
yes.
Not come here to court argue,
right.
But that the right of representation in the Court of Appeals included all the way to not just reading the answer, but discussing with your client whether or not a petition for review should be filed and filing the petition. After that, you're gone. So the right to be represented, and so what I'm putting, you know, where I'm going,
yes, you,
is the right to be represented at hearing includes, like it says in sub 8, 3, 8, rather, 205, sub 3, sub I. That says the client's right at hearing. Okay? The client's right at hearing includes I, the right to appeal the decision in accordance with sub 8.
Well, if you concluded that language gave a right to the assistance of counsel with regard to at least filing
the appeal.
Yeah, then it would be comparable to...
The Schmelzer.
To Schmelzer, and it would potentially be more limited than the concerns that we have, yes.
That's right. So we're just doing a Schmelzer thing. So what I'm advancing, the linchpin is whether or not my reading of the client's right at the hearing includes the right to appeal the decision in accordance with sub 8. How else, what does that mean if it doesn't mean what I'm advancing? Or tell me what it means. The client's right at the hearing includes the right to appeal the decision. I mean, it seems to me it's just analogous to Schmelzer, except there we're saying you have the right to have your an attorney to file the petition for review, that's it. But the right to appeal, the right to have an attorney on appeal includes up to filing the petition for review, and if they miss the deadline, it's ineffective assistance of counsel because you have the right up until then. You don't have a right to claim ineffective assistance of counsel unless you have a right to counsel. So I think that's what that means, and I can't figure out what else it would mean. What else would it mean? Do you have any idea other than the interpretation that I'm giving to it? The right, client's right at the hearing includes the right to appeal the decision.
Well, I would say it's not a model of great craftsmanship, but it could be interpreted in that way.
How else would you interpret that? The client's right at hearing includes the right to appeal the decision. Other than, give me a different interpretation.
I don't have another one. Now, the one difference here is that, of course, this appeal is all handled in writing, whereas in the Supreme Court, you file the petition for review, and then if it's accepted, of course, there's a lot more that goes on, and there you don't have the right. But here, by filing the administrative appeal, in essence, you would be doing the appeal.
But then it's not over with either, because you have the right to go to circuit court on cert for appeal.
Well, we certainly don't think that...
I'm not suggesting that an attorney attends with that appearance.
Right.
I'm just saying that you said once you file a petition, it's not over with, and I'm saying once you file an appeal with the administrator, after the appeal is filed with, it's not over with either, because then it can go to circuit court and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Seems to me... Please respond.
But it's over as far as the administrator is concerned. Let me just say a couple of other things with regard to this administrative appeal, and this is not in the record, but I tell you this is my understanding of how they do it. If somebody is concerned about a deadline, or pro se, or probably even attorney, they say, just file something. Just get it in time, and then we'll give you a certain amount of time to supplement it. So it's not like they always have to have everything in within the 10 working day period. So it's not as short as it appears to be.
And who would hear this appeal?
The administrator, Mr. Schwartz.
All right. Counsel, I assume that the division drafted these rules.
Yes.
And I assume the division drafted the information sheet that's given to the defendant, Mr.
Yes.
Mentor. So why aren't we going to say that sheet that's given to Mr. Mentor is really the division's interpretation of its own rules?
Well, I think you could say that it is.
And in fact, I think there are cases that say that where they have forms, they are really interpretations of these rules. So you can then say that the division's statement to Mr. Mentek would indicate that his attorney had the right to file the appeal. We already agreed on that.
His attorney did have the right to file the appeal.
He had a right to
It's a question of whether Mr. Mentag had the right to be represented by an attorney on the appeal. In regard to the cover letter, I don't think it says anything one way or the other about who can file the appeal particularly.
But you think that the cover letter does indicate that he had a right to either administrative appeal or cert or vote, that he did not have to exhaust?
I think that assuming that we're correct, that there is a requirement to exhaust administrative remedies by filing an administrative appeal before bringing a cert action, that the cover letter should specifically make that clear.
It doesn't, and it's not clear.
I agree that it is not. Now, if the court decides that Mr. Mentek was entitled to the effective assistance of counsel on the administrative appeal in this case, then we believe the case should be remanded for a Mockner hearing. Such a hearing is necessary to determine whether Mentek was advised by his attorney prior to the deadline for filing an administrative appeal.
Oh, you think something may have happened between the two letters?
I think it's possible. I don't know. I don't think it. It's certainly not clear from the record. And I've never spoken to Mr. Miller. This hearing should be held as part of a habeas proceeding rather than a cert action, because this court has indicated in Vanderbeek that habeas is the proper procedure for an allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel at a probation revocation proceeding when additional evidence is needed. If counsel was found to have been effective, then we agree with Judge Brown that Mentek should be allowed to file an administrative appeal anew and proceed from there. We ask that the decision of the Court of Appeals be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Wolfley. Thomas?
A couple points. The first, and as Justice Bradley referred to it, I think I'll refer to it the same way, the Schmelzer thing. I think you said...
Just a minute. I've got the site here. 201 West 2nd, 246. That's what I meant to say.
I think that's a great case. And frankly, in my presentation, which is long, and I never, of course, got to most of it, which is understandable, I talk about the Schmelzer case being, I think, very apropos in this case, because in there, Chief Justice Day did indicate that you have the right to counsel for the filing of a petition for review. And then he went the next step further and said that by failing to file it in a timely fashion, it was ineffective assistance of counsel as a matter of law. So I think that is a very important case, and it is very apropos in this case. As far as the ambiguity, and this goes to a lot of the statements made by the court during the presentation of the respondent, the drafters of this provision, it is the division's responsibility. They were the one who drafted it. So if there's going to be any kind of strict construction here, it should be against the drafters of these provisions. And again, I think as we see, reasonable minds are disagreeing as to the interpretation. And I think that I am a reasonable person. I think Judge Brown is a reasonable person. And as you know, the standard for ambiguity states that if reasonable minds can differ as to the interpretation of a statute or a provision, then it is ambiguous. And you need to look then further to the context of the provision, the history, and the scope. And if you do that, that gets into my third point on rebuttal, which is the public policy considerations. And Chief Justice, you mentioned that, and I think that's very important. I mean, what are we saying in this case when we uphold the decision of the Court of Appeals? Well, we're saying that an attorney can make a promise, say that he's going to do something which is very important to the defendant, renege on that promise, get paid for those services by the State Public Defender's Office in this case, and then leave the client with no remedy at law. And he has lost his due process right to file an appeal. So the public policy considerations, I think, are very important for you to consider here. And when you do look at those, They favor, again, a strict construction against the division and how they drafted it, and in favor of a more liberal reading of this to include the right to assistance of counsel on appeal. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Compton.
Thank you,
Mr. Wolford. Again, on behalf of the court, we thank Mr. Compton for participating in this program and taking this case. With that...